Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Worship Leader Podcast, brought to you by Worship Leader Magazine, which I don't know if you've heard it or not, but it is now a free resource. So after you're done listening to this podcast, go on over to worshipleader.com and check it out. You know, as we are starting off this new series, want to introduce ourselves. My name's Steve, and this is my wife, Sean.
Hey, everybody.
And we have the honored distinction of being your host for this program, which is really dedicated to bringing resources to you as worship leaders, as pastors, music ministers, because we ourselves are worship leaders. We've been involved with Worship Leader Magazine now for quite a few years.
Yeah.
We've been teaching at a lot of the conferences and have been writing for the magazine.
And we've been leading worship for like 25 years, which we started in high school, so that...
Well, it seems hard to believe because yeah. We don't feel like we're that old, but you know, 25 years of making a lot of mistakes and learning a lot of lessons. And so, you know, our involvement with Worship Leader has really brought us into contact with some of the industry's top and leading people in the field of worship. And so we're excited to be able to share that with you and for you to be able to listen in to some of the conversations with people that can really help us take to the next level.
Because sometimes it just takes one moment or one statement that can bring so much revelation to what you're called to do.
I know that's been true for us. And yeah. So, you know, as we get started here in our first episode, we're going to be talking with Matt Marr.
You're going to love getting to know Matt Marr and part of his story.
And then we're also going to talk a little bit about songwriting. We also then really dive into some piano tips because he is a classically trained pianist. And, you know, a lot of us need some help. And how do we translate all of those things into a modern worship style? So even though you're not going to be able to see what he's doing here in this audio podcast, you can definitely hear the examples.
Yes,
and we talk through all of those things. But if you do want to watch what's going on, there is a video version of this that will be available. So you can also check that out. But, you know, hey, if you're driving or doing something that can't take your eyes off of, definitely the audio podcast is going to be equally as rewarding. So without further ado, want to get into our conversation with the one, the only, Matt Marr. Here with Matt Marr.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey.
Thank you for coming and joining us. We're sitting around the piano because
you are a piano player. That's why I came. You have a giant, nice piano in your house.
So.
Yeah, that's probably why we bought the house, actually.
Yeah,
I was like, there's room for the piano? Yes, all right.
So I know a lot of people would instantly recognize you, but one thing that we've been asking everybody, which has been very interesting, is when people ask you, what do you do?
What
do you tell people?
I chase after my kids. That's kind of what I do.
It's 90%. How many kids do you have?
I have three.
Three?
Wow. Yeah, three, almost six and eight.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very
so,
fun.
Yeah. So that's a full time job, and in between, I write songs and lead worship, maybe just to keep my sanity. Or no, they're probably my sanity,
yeah.
And that's the stuff that drives me crazy. But no, I've been in Nashville now for going on 7 years.
Wow.
And my wife and I moved here. So we could be closer to her family. She grew up in Western New York. I grew up in Canada, but I've been in Phoenix for like 18 years. So.
Well, like many Canadians.
Yes.
In
Phoenix, of all places.
Yeah.
A lot of Canadians actually go there in the wintertime.
Oh, yeah.
They call them snowbirds.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, we went there for a Coyotes hockey game.
Did you really?
And they were playing Edmonton, and there was more Edmonton fans.
Yes. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Like, Where are we?
Yeah.
So tell us about growing up in Canada. Are you a big poutine eater? I mean,
I did a little bit. Newfoundland just kind of has like its own sort of like cultural dishes, if you will, that still involve potatoes, but fried fish, French fries.
It's more on the water.
And then what they would do is the dish would be called chips, dressing, and gravy. And so what it was potato, French fries with like turkey dressing.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Or chicken dressing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And then gravy poured all over the whole
that
thing.
That sounds amazing.
It actually is really good. Yeah, it actually comes now with a serving of Lipitor for your cholesterol, which is nice.
On the side, that's
yeah.
good.
On the side, yeah.
There is something about gravy in the North. We were just in Canada this spring, and everything has gravy, and I loved
they're
it.
Like,
it's because it's so cold. It's insulation.
It's not going to happen.
It's like spray foam for your insides. So
that's awesome. So did you guys vacation down there and ended up then, because you went to school at ASU?
Yeah, so my mother was American, and she kind of lived all over. She was a Navy brat, and her parents had retired in Northern Arizona. There's a town in Northern Arizona called Snowflake, which I always think is hysterical. Yeah. So it's
yeah, the farthest thing from
exactly. Snow. Yeah.
It's intended to be sarcastic.
Yeah. Yeah. So my parents got divorced in 95, and my mom wanted to be closer to her parents. They were getting older. She'd just been through a scare a couple of years previous where her mother had had like quadruple bypass surgery.
Oh, wow.
So she decided to make the move and kind of start over. And it was rough. Like, it's stuff that you don't even, like, there was just a lot of personal change and stuff that it just, anybody's, you know, when marriages end, it's just really, really difficult. So she kind of made that move, and right at the last minute, I was going to stay there. I just felt like I needed to go. Mm-hmm. And I didn't go to church really at the time. Wow. You know, I grew up going to church on Sundays, born and raised Catholic, but I just kind of stopped going in high school. And it really just didn't mean that much to me, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, there's probably a million and one reasons, you know, that you could maybe articulate. I think I grew up at a time when, especially in that part of the country, faith and Christianity, it was something that was much more of like a cultural touch point. It was something that you kind of participated in key moments of your life, whether it's like, you know, you go to Christmas and Easter, you go to church, you know. And then you end up at a wedding, and you end up at a funeral, and somebody gets their kid baptized or christened. And so you know, church becomes this thing that you kind of check in with like every couple of years.
Yeah. Especially in the Western part. Yeah.
Like, yeah.
We found out, we lived in Colorado for a long time. It's like you either were Christian or you were not.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what it was like for me in Canada. But when I moved to Arizona, my cousin who had moved 10 years earlier actually was part of this really dynamic faith community.
Oh, wow.
And it turned out that there was like a charismatic community within the boundaries of this parish, which was probably, I think, one of the reasons why it was such a dynamic parish. Yeah. So I was there for a year. I ended up full time on staff at another Catholic church for 13 years.
Wow.
So I finished my degree, got a degree in jazz performance on piano.
That's awesome.
At Arizona State.
Love that.
And that was not something I'd planned. I wasn't like a huge, you know, jazz player. I took a jazz piano studio class,
and just
I was practicing. Well, I was a piano major.
Yeah.
So I just kind of, put in enough work to fool the director. I think the director of the department had a soft spot for me because he was also a Christian, and I think he just knew that I was obviously gonna be in music, you know. But it was hard. It was hard finishing a college degree.
Yeah.
I did the same degree. Actually.
Really?
Just not jazz.
But not jazz.
Classical. Right.
Yeah. It's hard because I think it's like so academic, and there's so much discipline involved in terms of like the amount of practice that's involved.
Can you still play some of the pieces? Could you break off something for us right now? A little jazz number.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, sure.
That's the thing about jazz, is you're just like, it's intended. You just,
It's all there.
need to practice more. That's what this tells me.
With my wife being a piano major, it's funny because she still plays the things that she learned, you know, like, but it was so many hours of practicing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Hours and hours and hours.
And that's the hard thing that I think for me was there was kind of a conscious choice where I was either pursuing being the best that I could at playing the piano playing jazz standards and trying to master that instrument. But then I got involved in youth ministry. Yeah. And so there was a point where it's like you're either spending time just in ministry, which is mostly relationships. So it's a lot of time just spending time with people.
It takes time.
And I felt more and more called to that. And so it was really hard. It was even hard just finishing the degree because there's so many times I wanted to drop out. And then I was spending.
We got married in the middle, so.
Well, I was spending.
Like, yes, finish.
Yeah, I was spending so much time like trying to figure out how to play the guitar because that was the thing too. Where it's like
music was totally different space.
Oh yeah, I was trying to figure out how to play like "Open the Eyes of My Heart" and like in that open E chord progression that Paul Balazs used to play. Yeah. So that's what I spent. You know, I would spend 3 hours a day practicing the piano, but then I would go home to my apartment. I would spend 2.5 hours trying to play Delirious and Paul Balazs and Daryl Evans and like and early Passion stuff. And then I was at a Bible study for, you know, teenagers at the church that I worked at, leading worship. And so it just became a thing where that was so much more obvious to me that was my calling.
Yeah.
And it was probably because I really just wasn't that great at piano playing. I've managed to fool everyone.
Well, you find out in those environments like how amazing somebody
the
can
next
be.
Level, the next
oh.
level.
Well, and jazz is like a religion. It
that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
No, it is. And there's like a whole it's an all-encompassing field of music that you kind of dive headfirst into. Yeah. It's the same thing with studying classical music. You know, I had a lot of friends who were performance majors, and you're really like to get into like the pedagogy of it and the discipline of it and the philosophy of it. It's a lifelong endeavor.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I stumbled into writing songs about my faith and then particularly songs at church. And that was where I hit my sweet spot.
Yeah.
So talk about the Catholic charismatics and
yes,
you know, I know for us in our Protestant, we have all of our different groupings, but there's even within the Catholic Church, much different groupings. And then, you know, how did they receive, you know, the modern praise and worship style that you were bringing as compared to what we're doing and how that was?
Well, I mean,
Sunday.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was I was just formed by just going to these prayer meetings. A handful of them, and you know, kind of getting immersed in the sense of that there was a history and a tradition, like to the renewal period, which was like in the late 60s and 70s, that was happening simultaneously as the Jesus movement kind of happened. You know, a lot of people tend to think of that as just an evangelical expression. The reality is that there was a charismatic renewal of the whole Christian church everywhere. It's really what happened, I think. Is that, you know, it's like you could probably say that, you know, it talks about God says, I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh.
Lot
of us.
The Baptists.
No, and not just a bunch of hippies in Southern California. Yeah. It was like it was everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where, you know, like if you look in the 60s, there were all of a sudden they were doing these folk masses. There was a lot of innovation musically happening within the Catholic Church, and then it kind of hit a wall. And some of that is just like it's like a whole different podcast, really and honestly, a different conversation about the use of technology in church and is there a limit to how much technology should you use versus how much stuff should just be like, you know, for lack of a better term, organic.
Yeah.
Right.
I think what I've learned is this, is that everyone, every group, every denomination, every clique within Christianity ends up developing a songbook. of songs that they know and they love, and it sort of travels with that generation. And then typically what happens is that generation gets older, and then they look back at the younger people, and the younger people are singing these new songs, and they're like, well, we don't understand any of these new songs. These aren't as good as our songs. Remember, our songs, these songs are awesome. I'm not too sure about those songs. And that sort of has happened for decades and decades and centuries. And now we have people who love songs that were written 250 years ago, and we have people who love songs that were written 500 years ago, and we have people who love songs that were written 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's all sorts of discussions about what's a congregational song supposed to do?
Yeah.
Like, functionally, what it's supposed to do, you know, theologically, what is it supposed to do? So I think for charismatics, whether you're Pentecostal or you're Catholic charismatic or whatever, I think songs are they're the framework, mm-hmm. if you will, for prayer.
Yeah.
But they're kind of like a playground. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so I think most people who have more of a spirit-filled understanding of like corporate worship, prayer, mm-hmm. singing, the idea that the Spirit of God actually interacts with us as we're praying and singing on an active level. Mm-hmm. I think people who come from that background tend to look at songs as sort of being, it's like if you bordered a playground with a fence, you know, like the fence is the song structure in a way, you know, and then it's like, well, what happens within it, you know? And it's like, depending on what church you're at or what, you know, background you're part of, it's like, I remember some people loved singing in tongues because they love praying in tongues, because that's like a really big part of it, right? Then you get to like another generation 15, 20 years later, and they get real apprehensive about it because none of their friends go to church. And their friends are like, why are you people babbling in it? Like, what sounds like a weird language.
Yeah.
So then they don't do it anymore, mm-hmm. you know? But then eventually something else breaks out, which is like, oh, well, we're going to sing spontaneous stuff, but we're just going to use language that's more abstract or artistic or less biblically influenced. And you know what I mean? Yeah. We're going to, you know, sing about, you know, planetary structures or...
over and over,
and there's a community in France called Taizé. It's a monastic community of mostly Reformed monks.
Wow.
And their charism is they sing, it's kind of like the Moravian tradition, I think. Like, they just sing parts of scripture.
Wow.
Like, just over and over and over and over.
Just put melody to it.
Yeah, they just put a melody to it and they sing in it. They sing in harmonies and stuff. And so it's like, and like you hear like a 10-minute version of a song now, and it's like, why are these people just singing the chorus over and over again? It's like, because that actually goes all the way back to like Judeo-Christian.
Yeah.
Like, right. It goes back to Judaism.
Yeah.
Singing the Torah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Get it in you.
Yeah. I mean, the Eastern Orthodox, every Easter, sing this passage, Christ is risen from the dead, trampling over death by death, and redeeming us from the grave. That's where the song Christ is Risen that I wrote came from.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, and that's what they do. They literally, they march around their church, which is a very charismatic thing to do.
It is.
You would not think of that when you think about Orthodox, like literally the name Orthodox. You think of like a really neatly confined box.
Yeah.
But yet they march around a church, you know, singing that.
Oh.
So it, you know, I guess to answer your question, I think the church as a whole is always caught in the tension of trying to receive like fresh ideas and fresh ways of doing things. Those are kind of like methods, but what we're saying and what we're trying to communicate, no, there's nothing new under the sun.
Right, nothing new.
No. You know?
You're so correct. Yeah,
So you know, that's kind of pretty much what I did. I was part of that community, and then I worked at a church for 13 years, and I started writing songs, and eventually some of them, I guess, were relatable, I think, enough in a way that other artists or other worship leaders wanted to record them. And then that opens the door, and then you have to pray about it and say, well, is this, you know, am I supposed to walk through this, or am I just supposed to ignore it? And then, next thing you know, I live here and I chase around my kids. And when I'm not doing that, I'm still trying to write songs.
So how many songs are you writing, like a week, would you say?
Oh, man, it's not a lot. I just tend to now, I think, it goes in spurts. Mm-hmm. So there's songs that, like, I've started that, I've been working on for months. Mm-hmm. Like, I've got a new song that I'm actually, later today, I'm supposed to get a mix of.
Great.
And I started it in April, and I just finished it like a week ago.
Wow. Yeah.
Like the kind of the lyrics. Mm-hmm. The music part came, but I find myself more and more kind of wrestling with lyrics. Mm-hmm. Cause I think if you're going to say something simple, I'm just trying to be real as specific as I can about it. It's funny, people, you know, sometimes people, especially within Christianity these days, tend to be so hypercritical of the lyrics of modern worship music.
Yeah.
But, and they just think it's like, it's so simple to write a song like that.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's easy to throw a bunch of words together. But the problem is that the human heart tends to tell when someone's lying.
Yeah.
My kids especially. So there's, I can't explain it, but there is a level of intentionality that's like hyper-focused in terms of writing congregational music.
Yeah.
Because it's like one of the only genres of music where like the words matter.
It really matters.
They really, really matter. Yeah. Like you're not just trying to like throw out, here's a feeling or here's an image. It's, you know, because it immediately gets thrown into, well, we're all going to try to pray this, or we're all going to read this together, which in and of itself is like an act of prayer. So, so that song is called Lord of My Life. And,
can you give us a little sample?
Yeah.
Don't do the whole thing. But you can just whatever.
Sky without a north star, a ship without an anchor, caught up in the current, my heart is prone to wander. All the roads I've taken lead me back to nowhere. And you're the destination, and you're the way to get there. You can't hide it all. Be the song I sing. I think, you know, I can't help not find phrases that are kind of part of church lingo.
Yeah.
And,
it's woven into that.
And try to reexamine it. I grew up Catholic. People never said, can I tell you about my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ? Yeah. And now the more I've thought about it, the more I've thought, I don't understand why it became that way.
Yeah.
Because it makes so much sense to me. Like, I recognized Jesus as my Savior
Yeah.
before I allowed him to be my Lord.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which and, I think is true for most people.
Which I think is true for most yeah. people. Yeah. So that's the part that I always find weird, where it's just like, can I tell you about the Lord of my yeah. life? The guy who's in complete control of my life. Oh, and by the way, he saved it. I'm like, you'd never make someone your Lord before you made recognize or made them or recognize that they are your Savior, yeah. you know?
Not willingly.
Yeah, nah, not willingly. And so it's like, I think for me it was, and I think at this point in my life too, I've understood, I'm coming to understand the distinction. I think people look at Jesus as a lot of things. And I think in worship mm-hmm. especially we do. He's, yeah. we're so quick to want to say he's friend, he's confidant, he's yeah. journeyman, you know, he's counselor, yeah. he's unconditional love, acceptance, he's mercy, he's forgiveness, he's all those things. But to say he's Lord,
it requires something on us.
It, there's another level of surrender, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a reason why Jesus Take the Wheel was such a great song. And I think because it yeah, communicated sure. something on an unconscious level of yeah. like, and that's the thing, you know, this buddy of mine who taught like New Testament, or he taught the whole Bible narratively in Phoenix at the church that I worked at. Yeah. He used to talk about how rabbinical Messianic Jews, when they look at the Old Testament, every time there's the Lord is referenced in the Old Testament, mm-hmm. that's a reference to Jesus.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
metaphor and shadow.
Yeah. Really it's just like the preeminent or the preeminent Christ. And so
there's, and they wouldn't even say his name, right?
No,
they
yeah.
wouldn't say his name.
No. Yeah. But so there's something about, there is something significant about calling Jesus Lord.
Oh, yeah.
And, well, one of the most challenging scriptures is when Jesus is like, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and yet you don't do the things I do? And every time, or things I ask you, and every time I read that, I'm just like, okay. Next level, you know?
Back to the basics.
But I was doing pretty good.
Yeah. No, it's very true. So I think, you know, that was the thing for me with like, so an example would be like, you know, writing a song like that. You know, Lord, I Need You, though, was written in 15 minutes.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And I wish, oh, maybe not 15 minutes. Maybe, I mean, maybe it was over the span of like an hour, like between 15 and 90. Like it was that's written in a morning. Yeah. The whole thing, it just came together so unbelievably fast. Mm-hmm. We were sitting around a picnic table, like not too much bigger than this piano. And yeah. it was just a very quick collaborative process, and songs don't all come like that.
No,
I wish they did. I would be way more productive.
Yeah. We all would be.
Yeah.
Snap, it's done.
You know, I do. I have a lot of friends who push back on me and tell me, I've got friends who are in like different areas of like, you know, entertainment.
Yeah.
Like writers, you yeah. know, TV and stuff, mm-hmm. and they're always telling me like, hey, can you just write what you feel? Do you always have to like? Make it some sort of like didactic song about faith. Like, can't you just like do something more autobiographical, you know? And I think part of me wants to, but at the same time, it's like, I have a deep amount of respect for people who can write that way.
Yeah.
Because they are really wordsmiths. And so I think I'm still getting my feet wet in terms of like learning how to articulate my faith
yeah.
and how I feel about that before diving into like the whole of like the human experience. Yeah.
So in a writing session, you know, some people are chord people, some people are like
yeah.
melody,
and some people are lyrics, some mm-hmm. people are just, they handle the production, the sound of it. Are you stronger in one or another, would you say? Or who do you...
What comes easier for you?
I hate to say this. It depends on the day.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's some days where I walk into a session and I don't have... I'm like going... I'm not... Lyrics aren't creatively coming, so I usually switch gears.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things I would like encourage people to learn how to do. It's like develop one or two skills so that if one isn't firing on all cylinders...
Yeah.
You can just say, okay, that's not working today. I'm gonna do this. And there's lots of things that you can do creatively in terms of like freeing up yourself creatively. There's a book called Writing Better Lyrics by Pat Pattinson,
mm-hmm.
who's a teacher at Berkeley.
Yeah.
Right. And I just got it because John Mayer said he read it every year.
There you go.
So I went and got it, and I've been reading it, and it's really, really good.
Good.
And it approaches the idea of lyric writing as it is a muscle mm-hmm. that you can exercise and that you just have to put the work in.
Mm-hmm. And people talk about that a lot in songwriting. They're like, you know, when you work out for athletics or whatever, like you don't remember, you know, lift number 7 of the set or whatever. Like,
yeah.
But it's training you to get stronger. So then whenever you're doing something athletic or you come across a burning car that needs to be flipped over, you know.
You can do it.
Yeah, yeah, those are memorable moments. And so a lot of people aren't willing to put in the time songwriting, just writing songs that no one will ever hear, no one will ever remember, songs that won't turn out. But then when it comes to that moment,
yeah,
you know, then it's like, oh, hey, yeah, I'm in a room with talented people or just the whatever comes together and I know what that lyric's supposed to be. And, so give us an idea of like, just guess, how many songs have you written in this year or even
oh, the man. Of your life? I mean, this year is probably, I think this year I've probably written over, co-written over 30, 40.
Yeah.
You know, I would say that I never give myself a number of like, I need to write this many this year.
Yeah.
But I actually know I do have a lot of songs left in me this year. I can tell that. I mean, I think as you're growing, it's like what you said, it's exercise. You got to exercise the muscle. You got to work it out.
Yeah.
And then I think it, you know, I'll hear production ideas, but I'm not a massive track guy. You know, I'm stumbling around still. Which is dumb because like we live in the day and age, you can pretty much learn how to do any, I could learn how to fly a jet on the internet and like I can't, and this is what I do for a living and I still, I'm like, how do I get?
Just let the people that are good at it do it.
Well, this sound like your barista's better at it.
I know, it's so funny. Yeah, it's like, hey, do you have time to tune a vocal later?
Melodyne, you know?
Yeah. Right now. So.
Amazing. Well, I wanted to talk maybe, and partly why we're on the piano, is just so many people in churches are classically trained piano players who grew up with hymnals and written music, who are struggling mightily in our no music chord and stuff. And I wondered if you could just kind of show what you're doing on some of your songs and then like how you would play them different, just to give people like some basic chord forms.
Yeah, sure. Like so, I mean, I think the number one rule I've learned with playing in church, and it's not just even playing in church, it's just in every musical situation, is that less is more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times we can overplay.
Yeah.
I'm super guilty of it still. If I'm just playing just by myself and I'm singing, especially on piano, like I will overplay stuff way too much. You know, what I would say to piano players is that really what you're doing is you're just reinforcing harmonic information that's there and occasionally maybe playing like some kind of counter melody or like tag note at the end of a chorus or at the intro of a song.
So give us an example of overplaying versus simplicity.
Yeah, so like, you know, so Lord, I Need You, for example. So... You know, and I think piano player, like every musician, depending on like if it's a guitar player or if it's an acoustic guitar player, I think a lot of times we I think especially when you're learning how to play in an ensemble,
yeah.
One of the things that you don't necessarily, no one hands you a manual with like five rules, but one of the rules is like, if you can't actively hear what everyone else is playing, you're probably playing too much.
Yeah.
Yay, that's what we tell people.
So yeah, what I would say, it's like, if you can't, if whatever it is that you're playing is so complicated that you can't actually admire.
Yeah.
Right.
What the bass player or what the drummer or like what everyone someone else is doing, then you're occupying too much of the space.
Well, we run into a lot of people will then use in-ears not to hear other people.
To hear themselves.
Yeah. So then the problem, you can't even tell that you're doing it because you turn yourself up, everybody else down.
Yeah.
So for us, we play usually without monitors even at all sometimes just for that purpose.
Yeah.
So we want to hear what they're doing.
If I can't hear what I'm doing, then then somebody's playing my part, or we're, you know, and then we work it out orchestrationally.
I've destroyed my hearing because I'm always have one in-ear out because I just want to hear the church. I just want to hear the room.
Yeah.
I just want to hear people sing. Mm-hmm. Like that. That's I don't. If I spent 5 hours a day in a practice room for 6-7 years of my life.
Yeah.
Just listening to myself play, and it was not one iota as rewarding as writing a song and hearing the church sing. So Because He Lives would be another great example, because that song's very like it's a little bit more rhythmic, but you know there's this ostinato of acoustic guitar player, just kind of to stay out of the way. If you feel like you're literally like running down a hill and you can't slow down, you know what I mean? Then don't, you don't have to play it. I think it's like always, I think the rule is always, simpler is better.
Yeah. So when you're playing a chord, are you playing 1-3-5, 1-3-5 in each hand?
No, usually the bass, it's like one note. Octaves,
yeah.
So like your grace is enough if you're, because that's the chorus, because someone's gonna go. And it's like, you just,
it's very different because it's him style, like. Because her grandma always yells at me when I get behind the piano. It's like, play the melody in your right hand.
I'm
right.
I know. All of a sudden, you're in Walgreens. That's it's playing in the background.
Yeah.
And it is, some of it's a generational mindset of like, but a lot of times if I'm teaching a new song, I will sneak in the melody a little bit the first couple of times.
Right.
Just to kind of help people.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But then after a while, it's like, you don't need to play. You don't have to just keep banging out the melody. Yeah. I think especially with piano players not feeling like they have to do that.
Yeah. And part of that, I think, is because they would sing the one hymn and they're not going to sing it again for sometimes another year.
Yeah.
Whereas we're more repetitive.
They're very much.
People can learn the melody.
Well, I think the other thing, too, is that especially if it's like you're a small church and it's like acoustic guitar and piano and percussion, the piano at that point, it's a harmonic instrument, but it also is a percussive instrument.
Yeah.
So the problem is if you're playing the melody, the funny thing about modern music is that there's usually some sort of syncopated or sense of syncopation that offsets from the melody to create a three-dimensional image, like picture of rhythm, like how the rhythm's supposed to function, right? And so, if you're playing, it's really hard for people to actually like clap. They don't, there's no
there's
two
no
and
one.
Four.
Yeah,
there's no two and four. You know what I mean? So like, especially on the chorus. You're greasy enough. Because then I was like, oh, now I know what the, now I actually know what the time signature is. Yeah. I can feel it from the music that's actually being played. So then I have something to kind of like base my movement on.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, if you don't give people that kind of information.
Especially non-musicians.
Oh, especially non-musicians. They're just lost. And, you know, because they're like, look, man, this is not what I do for a living.
Like, where do I?
This
what
is
do
that's
I
not
do?
Even a hobby. Like, I don't know. It's like.
Like, I play the radio.
Yeah, I play. Literally, that's the instrument I play. I play Spotify. So, yeah, I mean, I think, like, some of that stuff's like, it's just real. It's just probably more simple than you're maybe allowing it to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense.
We kind of tell people sometimes, like, if it doesn't sound like really stupid on its own, then you're playing too much. Like, it should just sound like really empty and hardly.
Well, if you dive in like the multi tracks and stuff, sometimes you'll hear, it'll be like this guitar is playing one note like over and over and over and over and over again. But like,
yeah,
you know. And
but with everything else, it sounds good.
It's like, so. Oh, that's genius.
Or when somebody's
yeah, singing. Yeah, that's like it's and I think some of it's the day and age in which we live. Music's gotten very, very minimalistic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's like a whole other conversation, you know, because pop music right now is super simplistic. But it's funny that where a lot of worship music sometimes ends up being like a ton of information.
Yeah.
There ends up being like, there's like three electric guitar parts,
yeah,
and each one's playing like one note.
Mm-hmm.
And which isn't bad. But I think at the same time, like if you're at a church of 250 people, you're just trying to figure out how to sing this song. You know, the thing I would remind people, the most important instrument is the assembly.
Yeah.
Everyone's singing together. That's the most important instrument. So just do whatever you have to do to make that the most important thing. And then just make sure that you're singing the words in a way that everyone can actually understand it and hear it.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause those are like, that's because of, that's the thing about worship music that makes it different.
Yeah.
It's what the lyrics are talking about, you know, it's creating, it's painting a picture, it's creating an atmosphere, it's doing all these, you know, different things. And then probably the last thing would be just try not to get in the way.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Yeah, let them sing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get them singing.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, check out Matt Maher. And got a website and got
I'm sure I do. Not that anyone. Yeah.
Instagram.
Yeah, yeah.
If you play music in different places, go check that out.
I have no cooking tips. I'm not a lifestyle brand, but occasionally I do talk about music.
That's awesome.
Well, we hope you enjoyed our conversation with Matt Maher, but don't go anywhere because Matt's going to be back in just a few moments to share his favorite and really funny worship fails.
They are so funny. You do not want to miss this.
But before we do that, we did want to give you the big news of what's happening here at Worship Leader Magazine and that we have the National Worship Leader Conference scheduled.
Yes, it is July 21st through 23rd right here in Nashville, Tennessee.
So you're going to want to make sure that you mark your calendars and get in those requisitions and all the approvals that you have to go through in order to get to the conference because it is such a great event because you're really engaging with the top professionals and the top influencers in the worship community, from artists to theologians,
songwriters and
vendors and
tech people from all over the world. They come here for this event.
Plus, you get to hang out with other worship leaders and really get away and get refreshed. And this year, that's going to be even easier to do because we have a new schedule.
It's going to be amazing.
You know, going to conferences, sometimes you get so busy that you don't get a chance to really absorb or even visit the city that the conference is in. And so we're changing it to where the first night is a night of worship, but then the next 2 days, we're opening up your evenings to be able to go and relax with your team and really just enjoy all that Nashville has to offer.
This is such a fun city. You are not going to want to miss this.
So we also are doing a special promotion for you, our podcast listeners, where if you go and sign up at worshipleader.com/NWLC, where you can get all the information that you need. But while you're there, when you're signing up, make sure you put in the code PS2020, which stands for Podcast Spring 2020. And if you use that code, you're going to get 25% off of your registrations.
And that's good until June 30th of 2020.
So go to worshipleader.com, find out all the information, and sign up today. We look forward to seeing you.
Worst time I ever bombed. It's kind of hard to nail that down because it tends to happen very frequently. I would say that when I worked at a church, whenever I led worship, my band had like bets on when I would hit my face with the microphone because I lose spatial awareness as I'm singing because usually my eyes are closed, which is kind of a terrible habit when you think about it, because usually you're singing, you're communicating things, and most people when they communicate actually try to make eye contact with people. Not prolonged eye contact, that's rather strange. But just periodically, like, check, hey, how you doing? How's your coffee this morning? Great, that's fantastic. Yeah, your kid, yeah, you might want to change that, whatever. But my eyes are closed, so usually my face would just randomly, like, hit the microphone, and it would make that sort of thud. So that would happen at least one service a week. But probably the worst bomb I ever made was, I was at this event in Sydney, Australia, called World Youth Day. It happens every 3 years. The Pope invites people, and you can find this on the internet. I gave this like 10-minute long sort of like speech in between songs. Felt very, kind of moved by the Holy Spirit. So then I go starting to play this song. It's on the piano, and it's like, come in behind it, and it's like I'm playing along with a track and it's real pretty, and then I go in to lean in to sing, and I didn't have a piano bench. I had like two stacking chairs, and one was stacked on top of the other. When I leaned in to sing, the top one slipped and my hand went like that on the piano in front of 10,000 people, and then I squat because I thought the chair had fallen. So then I was playing a song, doing a full leg squat for about 40 seconds, and then my legs were shaking. It was really terrible. So you can probably find that if you give it a Google.
That's amazing.
It's true.